Thank you so much, and thanks Professor Bhaskaran and Perimeter for having me here and organizing this talk. Oh, I'm audible, right? So topological insulators are something which have been talked about a lot for the last several years. So what exactly are topological insulators? So first of all, an insulator is something which has a valence band and a conduction band, and these two bands are separated by an energy gap where there are no energy levels which are allowed, that is this region. However, in case of topological insulators or topological phases, there are some available energy levels which can be occupied by the electrons. And those are the levels here drawn in green. So these localized states lie in the energy gap. The most important property of these localized states is that the properties of these states are unaffected by slight perturbations. Now, what are these slight? So, for example, if I have a two-dimensional system like that, in case of a topological insulator, these modes which lie within the energy gap are the modes which are localized right on the edge of the system. Similarly, in case of a three-dimensional topological insulator, there are boundary modes which lie in the energy gap and are localized on the two-dimensional surfaces which bound the volume of the 3D topological insulator. Now, what do I mean by these states being robust or unaffected by slight perturbations? It means that any impurity or any small change in the system is not going to affect the behavior of these boundary modes. Now, to understand that better, we look at the usual donut and coffee mug analogy. And so, as is known, if you smoothly deform a donut, you can easily change it into a coffee mug. But to change it into something like a cricket ball, say, or a sphere, one has to make a more drastic change in the system, such as introducing a hole or closing a hole in the system. So in this particular example, what is known as a topological invariant is the number of holes. So both a donut and a coffee mug have exactly one hole, whereas a cricket ball, the topological invariant, that is the number of holes, is zero. Now this topological invariant, which is a property of the bulk, is closely related to the boundary modes. And this is what is known as the bulk boundary correspondence. So basically, these slight perturbations are anything that do not affect this topological invariant. So the moment we introduce a perturbation which changes the topological invariant, the properties of the boundary modes are going to change. So that's what I mean by the bulk boundary correspondence. Now, some standard examples of topological insulators. In one dimension, for instance, we have the SSH model, which is the model for a polyacetylene chain. And there, depending upon the consecutive hopping strengths, we have zero-dimensional end modes. In two dimension, we have examples such as the quantum Hall effect and the quantum spin Hall effect. For instance, graphene with spin orbit coupling is a very good example of a two-dimensional topological insulator, which has one-dimensional boundary modes or one-dimensional edge modes. Similarly, in three dimensions, we have materials such as bismuth selenide, bismuth telluride, etc., in which the bulk is three-dimensional, whereas the topologically protected boundary modes live on the two-dimensional surfaces. Now, in all these examples, the common link is that all these were electronic systems. So all the boundary modes, the edge modes or the surface modes, are electrons. A new kind of a topological system which is being studied now is that of magnons, which is basically you have a set of interacting spins on a lattice, and the collective excitations of these spins on the lattice, also known as magnons, are the topological properties of these collective excitations is being studied, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I am going to study them using what is known as spin wave theory. And that's the plan of my talk. So first I will be talking about the ground state of spins on a very well-known lattice called the Kagome lattice. And I will look at the magnetic excitations on this. Okay, so what is a Kagome lattice? A Kagome lattice is basically a triangular lattice. And at each side of this triangular lattice, I have a triangular unit cell. So I place a triangle at each lattice point of a triangular lattice, and that gives me a Kagome lattice that looks like that. Now, each lattice site basically has three sublattices, which I call A, B, and C here. So there are three sites per unit cell. And as you can clearly see here, every site has four nearest neighbors. So for example, each A sublattice has two B kind of nearest neighbors and two C kind of nearest neighbors, and so on. Okay, so now we have the lattice on which we are going to work. Now, at each side of this lattice, I have a spin with magnitude S, and we allow for nearest neighbor interaction. So each A can interact with the two C's and two B's around it, and so on. So the first kind of interactions that we put in is the XXZ interaction. So I have the nearest neighbor S dot S kind of interaction, except that there is an anisotropy here. So at each site, I have a, so the at the three, the spin at each site is denoted by the kind of the lattice. So the spin at A, I call it as AN. Spin at B, I call it as BN, and so on. And each of these spins interacts with the nearest neighbor with this kind of an interaction. The J here is, the J alpha here is what is the, gives the anisotropy. So the X and Y components of the interaction is ferromagnetic, whereas the, I allow the Z component of the interaction to vary, and it differs from the X and Y components by a factor of delta. So if my delta is equal to 1, it is the usual ferromagnetic Heisenberg model. That's the isotropic case. Now this XXZ interaction, suppose I had only this, that would just force the spins to align parallel to each other. However, I have a second type of interaction, which is the Jalushinsky-Moria interaction, or DMI. The previous one was more like a dot product of the spins. This is more like a cross product term. And so here we look at only the out of plane components, which is dz. So the coefficient d here is basically the strength of the Jalushinsky-Moria interaction, and here we look at only the z component, which is perpendicular to the plane. Now this is true only for a perfect Kagome lattice. For a system with a lower symmetry, that is, when there is a slight distortion in the lattice, for example, there can be a small in-plane component, which is like dx or dy. But here, that's something that I'm neglecting. Now, what does the DMI do? The DMI tries to move the spins away from the parallel orientation. So that gives rise to a spin canting. And also, since there is a cross product involved, it gives a handedness to the system. So if I look at the triangle here, if I go with a positive sign of DMI, this HDM has a clockwise sense, whereas if I go with a negative, with capital D less than zero, that has an anti-clockwise sense. And also, this whole Hamiltonian, which is the sum of these two, is invariant under arbitrary spin rotations on the xy plane, which means I have only the relative orientations of the spin matter. So any overall rotation about the z-axis is okay. So as I said, the XXZ interaction tries to align the spins parallelly, whereas the DMI tries to move them away from this parallel orientation. And now there is a competition between these two terms. Okay, so now we know what the lattice is and what the interactions are. And now we look at the ground state configuration. And to study that, we work in the classical limit. And at each site, we assume that there is a spin S. And assume the polar angle and azimuthal angle are theta and phi. And since the whole system is invariant under an arbitrary rotation of the spin about the z-axis, only the relative orientations of the spin matter, and we choose the spin at the C sublattice to be on the xz plane. So the phi C is zero, and this is the form of the spins we are taking. Using these, we minimize the Hamiltonian with respect to these five parameters here, that is the thetas and the phis, and numerically find the minimum energy configuration. And with respect to the parameters delta, which is the anisotropy, and the d by j, which is the like the dimensionless version of the DMI DMI strength. This is what the phase diagram looks like. So it's a very rich phase diagram. Phase one is where all the spins point along the z direction, which is this one here. And here, so this is a collinear phase and a ferromagnetic phase where all the spins are pointing out of plane in the plus z direction. The second phase, which is one in the middle, shown in orange, is where all the spins are pointing along the x direction, which is also a collinear ferromagnetic phase. Phases three and four are where the neighboring spins are rotated by 120 degrees in the clockwise or the anticlockwise direction. And phase five, in which in general the spins are non-coplanar and the configuration is different for each delta and j. So in the phases one to four, as long as I'm within the phases, within those phases, the spin configuration or the spin orientation does not change with the values of anisotropy or the Jaloszynski-Moria interaction. But in the last phase, the fifth phase, in general, the spin configuration is different for different values of delta and d. Also, the all phase transitions lines between the first one to four phases are of first order, and we look at the we can figure out the phase boundaries by saying that the derivative of the ground state energy is discontinuous.
Excuse me. Are these the only phases that have least energy for these parameters?
For these parameters, yes.
There are no more longer period phases.
So here we have assumed that so all calculations we have done within one unit cell. So assuming that the periodicity of the lattice is
stretch.
Exactly. So assuming that the periodicity of the lattice and the periodicity
yes.
Exactly. Within that, these are the only phases that
we get. Sometimes you tend to get long range modulation.
Okay.
Becomes bigger.
Okay. No, we did not take that into account. We have just assumed that within one lattice, what is happening, that's getting repeated. Okay. So now we saw that there are these five phases with these phase boundaries and so on. And now that the ground state configuration in each of these phases is established, now we go on to study the spin waves in some of these phases. Okay, so first we will look at phase one, and we will look at the spin waves by the Hallstein-Primakov transformation. So what is the Hallstein-Primakov transformation? For example, let's see a 1D Heisenberg model, which is just a one-dimensional chain. Which has this kind of an interaction, that is the SI dot SJ, nearest neighbors. And so the ferromagnetic ground state, let's call it GS. And here we know that all the spins have to be aligned parallel to the Z direction, say plus Z. Now, in the ground state, all these spins have maximum spin projection along the Z direction. And the ground state energy is given by this. Now, what is the first excited state? Naively, one would guess that it's just S minus at some site I naught operating on the ground state. However, that's not true because that is not an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. The correct eigenstate is a superposition of all such possible states with the spin projection reduced by one. And this first excited state can be obtained by using the Hallstein framework of transformation, which basically map the spin eigenstates onto a quantum harmonic oscillator-like states. So in this particular case, we have the ground state that looks like this. That is, so in phase one, we have all the spins pointing along the plus z direction. Now we use Hallstein framework of transformation that looks like this. So for example, we have the az is s minus a dagger a. So you reduce the spin projection by one. So if it was a spin plus half, it becomes minus half. And accordingly, change the other ax and ay by using the a plus and a minus operators, which are the angular momentum ladder operators. And this is, so under an approximation, this is what the form of these operators look like in terms of my harmonic oscillator states. Now, once these Hallstein framework of transformations are done, that change the spin configuration from this to this, then we use that in the form of the Hamiltonian, which the H delta plus HDM, and obtain, so once you substitute this here, and Fourier transform according to this, and retain terms which are only up to second order in the harmonic oscillator operators. And that is what one gets. So the Hamiltonian looks like this. So in terms of A dagger, B dagger, A, B, C, and A dagger, B dagger, C dagger, that is the harmonic oscillator states at each of those sublattices, H of K has this form. So here we can clearly see three things. First, it's a number-conserving Hamiltonian, which means there are no A dagger, or A dagger, B dagger kind of terms. Therefore, just directly diagonalizing this H of K gives you the energy spectrum. Second point, the anisotropy delta appears only as an overall energy shift. It appears only on the diagonals. And the third, the energy spectrum depends only on the magnitude of the DMI strength, that is, it is symmetric under d going to minus d. Also, since it's a 3x3 matrix, because it's a 3 sublattice problem, there are 3 bands in the spectrum. And that's what it looks like. So here what I'm going to show you in this animation, I'm basically moving in the phase diagram. I fix delta, that is the anisotropy, and I move along this line. And this is, so right now the picture is, sorry, the top band is not visible properly, but it's just a flat band. And the other two bands are touching at these two Dirac cone-like points. And if I move along the delta equal to 2 line, this is what it looks like. So at every time this line is crossed, the bands become gapless, and at all other times the bands are gapped. So what I have shown here is just one Brillouin zone, and there are 3 values of d by j where the gap closes in this phase. And so all these calculations are just for phase one, and at all these 3 points the gap closes. Okay, so this is an easier way to see. So here I'm just plotting the energy gap versus the DMI strength. And what we see is exactly at d equal to 0 and root 3, the gaps close, and both these energy gaps close exactly at the same point. And at all other values of d, the system is capped. Also, so another thing to notice here is that the band one and so if I'm in this region, the band one and if I'm in at this line, the bottom and the middle band touch at these Dirac points, whereas bands two and three touch at the gamma point, that is at k equal to zero. Once I reach this line, that is the Jaluzinski-Moria strength equal to root 3, these band touching points are switched. So bands 1 and 2 touch at the gamma point, whereas bands 2 and 3 touch at the Dirac points. That's just an observation. Now, except for these three special points in this phase, everywhere else the spectrum is gapless, which means whenever the spectrum is gapped, one can calculate a topological invariant because the Berry curvature is no longer ill-defined. And this is how we calculate the Chern number for this phase. So we calculate the Berry curvature using this, using the wave function at every momentum. And the Chern number is basically the integral of this Berry curvature. And what we find is as follows. So if I am in this region, the bottom, middle, and top bands have these Chern numbers, that's plus 1, 0, and minus 1. And as I move, so when this boundary is crossed, these Chern numbers are flipped. So now this becomes minus 1, this is 0 and 1, and so on and so forth. So every time the energy gap closes and reopens, there is a change in the topological character of the bands, which means the Chern number is flipped. Okay, so we know that, so by the bulk boundary correspondence, we know that these topological invariants, which are the Chern numbers in this case, are closely related to the edge modes of the system. So whenever the Chern number is non-zero, I would expect to have a edge mode which is robust, which is protected topologically. And to study these edge modes, we look at a ribbon of finite width. So I have a ribbon of Kagome lattice that looks like that. The top edge is more like a zigzag edge, whereas the bottom is a flat, straight edge. Since it's a ribbon, we have translational invariance along the x direction, which means the momentum in x direction, that is kx, is a good quantum number. We have ny sites along the y direction, which gives me a 3ny by 3ny Hamiltonian, because there are three sublattices at each unit cell. And this is what the edge modes look like. So this is something like a projection of this along the E versus KX plane, except that because now the system has been chopped off in the Y direction, there are edge modes which are visible in the spectrum. So between the bottom and the middle band, there is one edge mode, and between the middle and the top band, there is another edge mode. Now this is consistent with this formula. So the magnitude of the Chern numbers below a gap, the sum of the Chern numbers below a gap, the magnitude of that quantity, gives you the number of edge modes in the system, which is consistent with this observation. So the bottom band has Chern number plus 1, and there is exactly one edge mode between the bottom and the middle band. Similarly, between the middle and the top band, there is exactly one edge mode, and the top band has Chern number minus 1. And this can be seen for all the phases which are topological. That is, whenever my d by j is away from 0.
So all the edge modes have a gap. They're above the ground state.
Yes, so the ground state is here, and so the first magnon band is gapped from the ground state.
The edge modes are above.
Above that. So because this is the edge modes of the magnons itself. So the Chern numbers are of the magnon band and not the ground state itself. Okay. So this fact that there is a topological invariant which is non-trivial, that is a non-trivial Chern number, can be seen by studying the thermal Hall effect.
Can you
Sorry, I asked that before, but going back to your phase diagram. So these phases with non-trivial trim numbers that's talking about, where are they again in that phase diagram?
So it's all here. So these four phases. So it's like, so this phase itself is one particular ground state configuration. On top of that, there are these four sub-phases here.
Right. So, and these phases are ferromagnetic or?
Yes. So the ground state is completely ferromagnetic.
Okay. From a materials perspective, right?
Okay.
So now you're in the large delta limits, very strong anisotropy.
Yeah.
So have you thought about what's the materials context where this might be observable?
So I have taken a large anisotrope.
That's right. So there's some work by Young Lee, I believe, and Chisnell.
Okay, yeah.
This is their letter a couple of years ago. I think they looked at some Kagame system where they found that there's some elastic neutron scattering, perhaps. It's also some work on how for system validate. That's also believed to have these systems have quench angular momentum, very small anisotropy. So I'm wondering where you're positioning that story in terms of materials.
Okay, so here I have taken the large anisotropy so that it's easier to represent on this plot. But even for a small anisotropy, I'm just slightly away from this line.
What does it put? Oh, right. So you're...
It is still within that phase.
Right.
Do you have any system in mind? Any?
That is the Eisenberg point, right?
Hmm. Yeah, so... If you are even delta is like just slightly beyond one, even that should be enough to see all these phases.
Right. So moving to the right of that line is perhaps material reasonable for 3D transition metal systems, but the upper and the bottom corners where the DM interactions of the order of like square root 3, this seems to be large, right?
Well, the DM interaction is square root 3 exactly at this line, right?
Yeah, but I'm saying that moving to the right of the delta equals 1 at d equals 0 is perhaps.
So, d equal to 0, that's your
system, right?
Right.
It would be sitting at d equals 0, delta equals 1.
Yes.
It would be right there. And so, in some kind of weak coupling, a spin orbit,
okay,
it would be weak. You'd be moving on a slope there, right?
Right.
Entering the purple region, the pink region at best.
Yes.
Yeah, but you was okay. So I'm just trying to see where you are in phase. So that phase is the most likely one that could be realized, especially that phase.
Yes.
That box there that you label.
So yeah, probably somewhere in this region. It's
yes. I was just trying. Yes. Okay.
Oh yeah. So Bhaskaran was asking. Okay, so fine. We talked about the churn numbers and the edge mode. So now, how can we see in an experiment, suppose, as to where these transition points are? And the answer is by using the thermal Hall effect. So what is the thermal Hall effect? You have a sample and you apply a temperature gradient along the x direction, suppose. And we see the heat current along the transverse direction, the perpendicular direction. And so the heat current in y direction and a temperature gradient in the x direction would give me a thermal Hall conductance kappa xy. And that has this complicated formula here. And here it depends upon this function C2. Which is in turn a function of the distribution function. And this distribution function rho I is the Bose distribution function because magnons are bosons. And this omega here is basically the Berry curvature of the ith band. And so the Berry curvature is directly related to the churn number or the topological invariant. And hence this measurement can effectively tell us where these transition points between these topological subphases is happening. again, we move along the delta equal to 2 line. Again, for it's just for clarity that I have taken this large delta 2, but it can probably even be seen closer to the delta equal to 1 line. So we vary the DMI strength, keeping delta equal to constant, and we stay within this phase 1. And what we see is every time the gap closing point is crossed, that is these subphase transition points, there is a sudden jump in the Hall conductance. So the D equal to minus root 3 line, which is here, that's here. Now, there is a sudden change sign between this phase and this phase. Again, once we cross the D equal to 0 line, there is another sign change, and so on. And this clearly tells us that there is a phase transition point there. And to see more clearly, we can take a cross-section of this and see the jumps are exactly at the D equal to minus root 3, 0, and plus root 3. And so these lines are basically for different temperatures. That's the average temperature. Okay, so that was about phase 1. So
I'm surprised about the jumps. Okay. So when the DMI strength is 0, then there is no thermal Hall effect, right? So
yes.
At D 0,
yes.
It's actually 0.
Yeah, so because so the D equal to
0.
0, yeah, here.
Then it's strictly 0.
Yes.
You go just a little bit to the right.
Right.
It jumps. To the left also it jumps. Is that so? For instance, if temperature is 0,
right,
there is no thermal Hall effect.
So, if the temperature is 0, that's just this line. Flat. Yes,
but you want it to go to 0 smoothly? No, it's topological, it's kind of
yes,
yeah. it's not a topological, it's not a conserved one, it's not fixed at plus 1 or minus 1. Yeah, but it's tracking the Chern number,
yes,
somehow, and dressed by all these badly geometric functions.
So basically, the formula.
It's just symmetry, right? The left and the right there?
Yes, there is. So essentially, like this and this are pretty much the same. And also, there is a d going to minus d kind of a symmetry in the whole thing. Okay, so. Fine. So we saw that in phase 1, we have a ferromagnetic phase, and we use the Holstein-Primakov transformations to study the magnon spectrum and looked at these four topological subphases. And we saw that the Chern numbers and the edge modes they agree with each other. And we saw that the thermal Hall effect can capture these transition lines. Now, what happens in the other phases? So, in the other phases, as we saw before, so that was the phase diagram. And so, what I'm going to talk about now is this phase and this phase. And in these two phases, we know that, again, in phase 2, for example, it is still a ferromagnetic configuration. That is, all the spins were pointing along the x direction, say. And by using similar Holstein-Primakov transformations, which are slightly more complicated in this case, we find that, again, there are three magnon bands. However, the spectrum throughout this phase is completely gapless. So there are no points where there is a band gap or anything. And yeah, so, but still we can do edge state calculations, even though they won't be topologically protected because the Chern number is trivial, because one can't really define a Chern number or a topological invariant here, but one still finds these edge modes. Similarly, in the third phase, which is in this phase where all these spins were rotated by 2 pi by 3, again we see that the spectrum is completely gapless in this phase. And again, the Holstein-Primakov transformations are a little more complicated. And we find that the magnon spectrums are gapless. And the edge states are hence not topologically protected because the Chern number is ill-defined. Okay, so to conclude, we looked at spins on a Kagome lattice, and we included two kinds of interactions, that is XXZ, the anisotropic nearest neighbor interactions, and the Zhalushinsky-Moria interactions, which give a handedness or a chirality to the system. The phase diagram had these five phases. In general, phases 1 to 4 are coplanar ground states, whereas in phase 5, in general, it's a non-coplanar ground state. Phases 2 to 4, that's the middle, top, and bottom regions, these are topologically trivial. That is, the spectrum is always gapless, and hence the churn numbers are ill-defined, and hence it's a trivial system. And hence the edge modes or the boundary modes are not robust against impurities and stuff. However, phase 1, where it was a ferromagnetic phase with all the spins pointing along the z direction, that is perpendicular to the plane, the spectrum was in general gapped, except for these four lines, that is d equal to 0 and plus minus root 3. And these lines divided this region into four subphases. And everywhere apart from these lines, the spectrum was gapless. And these adjacent, the spectrum was gapped. And the adjacent subphases differed in terms of the churn number, or more importantly, the sign of the churn number. And hence, differed in terms of the edge modes. And a way to look at this transition lines was using thermal Hall conductance. Some other interesting things that can be done here is, for example, what happens if we add next nearest neighbor terms? Would that significantly change the spectrum or the churn numbers and the edge modes? Another question is, what happens in phase 5? Is it possible to get a more complicated bulk or edge spectrum? And thirdly, what happens if there is an inplane Zhalushinsky-Moria interaction? So if it is an imperfect Kagome lattice, say, there is a possibility of having a small inplane component of the DMI. And it would be interesting to see what effect that has. So yeah, thank you for your attention. And that's the reference.
Do you look what happens if you change the sign of J and you go on the anti-magnetic side?
No. So here we have assumed that the X and Y interactions are completely ferromagnetic. So we have not really seen what happens.
So there's some work, right, by...
I think Laurel and Friedman?
Oweri?
Oweri, yeah. He's here.
Yeah, I think at some point. So he... What's a ferromagnetic? It's anti-magnetic. Look, off. I'm trying to position... Like, does your work relate to what he has done, or?
So he has worked on honeycomb lattices mostly.
Honeycomb lattice with next nearest neighbor DMI.
Yes.
I say Kagome. Not Kagome.
Not.
It's related work on lutetium analysis and Kagome. Right.
I asked about this other solutions with long periods.
Yes.
Your phase diagram has partly the answer because you always get a gap for the spin,
yes,
except along the lines.
Right.
So that means it's stable. It's like a stability analysis.
Right, right.
So negative frequencies are there. No,
right.
Negative frequencies.
Yes, yes.
Because I remember in situations where you get skirmion lattices.
Ah, I see.
Because of the, there's a small canting buildup and the leverage to long.
Okay.
I wonder whether there are some non-perturbative.
Gap she was talking about is between higher micron bands.
No, even it is also gapped out from the ground state.
The ground state, above the ground state.
Even in the easy plane anisotropy case, the delta is.
Yeah, there is a gap, and then.
No, not like this. Yeah. So the ground state is like below that.
But that's delta positive. But delta positive.
Yes.
Yeah. For less than one, it's not. Delta
less than one, it probably is. I'm not sure.
No.
I see. So there may be such in.
Yeah, because so in the less than one case, so Okay, so this is the delta equal to minus 2 line, and below this we have not really studied it. But yeah, I guess delta minus 1, I'm not sure. Probably there could be higher.
I remember the small twist build up.
Okay.
To give you a very long period.
I see.
Like mechanical cell.
Okay.
Yeah, but not in the local picture there.
Okay, you can give some approximate.
It is probably like in these criminal systems, you have like second and third neighbors, I think, which.
They also yeah. I'm wondering whether small canting alone will frustrate and lead to. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. In real system, you're right. Other interactions may favor such long periods.
But here, the Hamiltonian is quadratic. You can just calculate the chi of q, right? The mean field theory calculate the dependence set to begin and look at the soft mode and see where.
Correct. It's, at the moment, she doesn't seem to have any soft mode in this region.
But yeah, if I have next nearest neighbor, for example, then my unit cell is more, possibly is just a bow tie or the star or something. Then that might give.
But there's a whole set of literature on skirmion system. So related to Michelle's questions, you haven't thought about any real systems?
No, as of now, no.
Any additional questions? Okay, let's thank Ramchandran.